searching for the sound.
But I could only hear the preacher and the baying of his hounds.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 28th of October. Listening to the music of Phil Lesh, the co-founder of the Grateful Dead, who died at the age of 84 on Friday. And we'll remember him with our bumper music going into our segments throughout the panel this morning. And you can see our playlist posted at wamc.org/roundtable. Good morning, all. It is an absolute delight and pleasure to be with you this morning on this first post fun drive roundtable. It's been a little bit since we've been together and have had what I will refer to as a quote unquote normal show. But you know what that means. And we are thrilled to be out of fun drive. And first of all, let us just, from the bottom of our hearts, on behalf of everyone here, on the staff and the pitchers and the board and everybody, just thank you so much for making the drive and making the money and coming to our assistance and doing it in such a beautiful fashion. It was a very special drive. And I think one will remember for a long time in coming. And we certainly thank you for everything that you did. And to all the sponsors and to all the volunteers and to all the people who had any hand in the fun drive at all, we just so appreciate it. And that, of course, includes you who called that magic number and or went to your device and did something. And we are very, very happy to be back to normal programming. We said all along our whole goal was to go back to normal programming, so here we are. All right, that means we have a lot to catch up with. A lot of stuff has been happening and things that we need to talk about, and we'll do that with a wonderful panel this morning. Let me introduce them to you. Preceptor in Public Speaking, Strategic Communications, and Public Relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning, and congratulations on your fun drive. And
thank you.
So glad that worked out for you. And thanks for considering me to be part of your normal panel. I appreciate that.
Yes. Yes. We didn't drag you into the non-normal ones. But don't worry, it'll happen.
I've been there.
But, yeah, you have been there. Yes, you're right. You have been there. But it's a thrill to have you with us, and we thank you very, very much. Also joining us this morning, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler. Good morning. How are you, Jim?
I'm okay, Joe. A little bit depressed. The 2-0 Dodger League in the series. Not that I'm a big baseball fan, but these are my Yankees.
Yeah. Well, it will game 3 tonight, and back to New York, and we'll see. Or
we'll
not
see
back to New York, to New York, and we'll see what happens tonight. But yes, but it has. I understand there's people who are rooting for different teams, but some really good baseball.
It is.
It's some really good baseball.
Well, the other nice thing is it's a great distraction from the other national sport.
Well, that's
which we'll talk about.
That's
soon.
Right, exactly, which we'll spend the next 2 hours talking about. and executive director of the Legal Aid Society at North of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel here. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great, and congratulations on a great fun drive. I have to tell you, I listen to the on my way to work and during the day during the fun drive, and I do feel like I learn a lot about all of the folks who work here. So if I'm creeping on someone's LinkedIn or Instagram, don't be weirded out. It's just because I'm a fan of the fun drive.
Yeah, well, that's fine, and we're pleased. I mean, that's part of why we do what we do, but
well, there's not like another radio station that I want to listen to, right?
Right.
It's like it's this or I sit in silence. So I listen to the Fun Drive.
Well, we thank you very much for not sitting in silence, but for keying in and for listening to all the great people who work so hard to make the drive happen. All right. Well, let's begin with this. The closest presidential election in modern memory enters its final frenetic days, with neither Kamala Harris nor Donald Trump able to be confident of victory. I think one thing I am reading from the Washington Post, but I'm going to step away from that coverage in just a moment. And the reason I will say that one of the things that I think we always it was always a close race, and it was always close to tied, and it was very, very, very close all along. I think what we have seen in the few weeks that we've been away from the Daily Show is this really tightening to the point of we just have no idea, that it's deadlocked. And pollsters aren't even predicting because the numbers are so incredibly close. Back to the coverage. With tens of millions of early voters casting their ballots already, the outcome now depends on whether the campaigns can mobilize their bases and persuade the tiny fraction of the electorate still undecided about whom to support and whether, and this to me is the big one, to vote at all. Neither Harris, the current vice president, nor Trump, the former president, has a lead outside the statistical margin of error in any of the seven battleground states of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, or Wisconsin. That, according to a recent Washington Post school survey, the Post's current poll average aggregator. Nor does either have a statistical advantage in national polls, which are a reflection only of the popular vote. National polls published Friday by the New York Times and Siena College and by CNN, which I believe are the last polls they will release prior to the election 1 week from tomorrow, both show a literal tie, 48% to 48% in the Times, 47% to 47% from CNN, both among likely voters. A Wall Street Journal poll showed Trump at 47% and Harris at 45%, including third-party candidates. These polls mark shifts, if ever so slight, and still within the margin of error, in Trump's direction over the past few weeks. But Democrats say they do not see any movement away from them and that the race remains extremely stable. Both candidates are closing their campaigns with messages focused on fear. Harris agreeing with former Trump officials that the former president should be labeled a fascist, we'll talk more about that later on, argues that he represents an authoritarian threat to democratic institutions. She's also incorporating abortion and the threat to women's rights as part of her closing message. Trump, meanwhile, is telling voters they should fear an influx of undocumented migrants who, he says, would drain the country's resources and endanger people's lives. On Friday, he said America has become the world's garbage can. It is an echo of the message he delivered on the day he first announced for president in June of 2025. Terry Gibson, we'll let you begin.
Well, I want to bring a ray of optimism into this dark, gloomy assessment that you just created there. I actually do not think that it is going to be close. I think Kamala Harris is going to come out victorious, and I think it's going to be at a much wider margin than the press is reporting. I think a couple of things are going on here. First of all, the media realizes that you draw more eyeballs to your websites if it's a close race. The pollsters realize that you draw more eyeballs to their sites if it's a close race. All of this is about how this is being framed. One of the things that's being ignored is the tremendous ground game that the Harris campaign has. It is a ground game like no other campaign has ever had, whether it be the phone calling or the door-to-door or the letter writing. It is extensive and it is well-organized, and I've been participating in it at a high level for the last couple of months. And what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, is that the internal polling, what the reports are on the ground from that ground game, are showing that she is going to win this race. It does require that all of her supporters continue to participate in any way you can, whether it be going to KamalaHarris.com and signing up to make phone calls, going to Vote Forward and writing letters. There's still days left to do that. But I really do believe that we're going to be very surprised on Election Day, maybe not that day, but within a few days. And I'm excited about it. And I think it's important that we stay positive.
So let me ask, I'm very unfamiliar with our panelists being so positive, but I will, but good for you, Terry. I will say, I just want a little clarification before I go to your colleagues on the panel, and that is one of the things when you look at the national race that it does seem to be, at least in those two polls, the CNN and the Siena poll, of 2 points. But those are national numbers and don't take into account the Electoral College. So you feel as confident as you just described in the swing states that she can get to 270.
Yes, if the momentum keeps going between now and Election Day, I do feel that way. If you look at the crosstabs and all of these polls that are coming out, and you really drill down and examine what's happening at the district level, at the congressional district level, it's a very different outcome than what you see in this broad spectrum where there's these broad averages across the entire population, which isn't really relevant to how the vote is going to be determined. So I think there is a lot of good news that just isn't being clearly reported because it's complicated, it's hard to understand, and it makes for a much duller story than a close race. And I think for now, really, the fact that it's being framed as a close race is important because we need all the supporters to get out and continue to fight the fight. It's not to be taken for granted, of course. What I worry more about, really, is within 48 hours of it showing clearly that Kamala Harris is the winner, that all of the plans that the Trump organization has put into place to try to fight the election, to try to rig the electoral votes, to try to do whatever they can to stop the system from actually working the way it works. I'm just hoping that the Harris campaign is prepared for that. I think that's where the real concern is.
Nick Rangel.
Odds checker this morning puts Trump likely to win by like 65%. So I hate to rain on that parade, but I do think, you know, that it is actually still really tight, and I'm a little fearful. I would say I do still think there's like a silent group of people who have not really made their intentions known. They're the same. They're like the, you know, folks in more conservative communities that don't want to bring criticism on themselves, or potentially it's women in households where their spouses expect them to vote along their own, you know, political lines, things of that nature. And I do think there's still a lot of people who aren't being counted in that way, but the odds don't look good. I know the polls put them really close, but the odds do not put them that close. So you know, I think we should continue to work and fight and do, you know, as much as possible to make sure people get out and vote and people are participatory and they aren't sort of disenfranchised. But it's still a very tight race.
All right, Mr. Data Analyst, tell us what we need to know.
Well, you know, I'll tell you two things. One is I do agree with Terry that I think the reporting and the coverage really has been pushing hard for it to be a close race, whether on purpose or by accident. But just as an example, Trump and Harris held rallies in Texas the same day. Trump had, you know, one or two people who had either, who some kind of crime had been committed by an immigrant. Okay, Harris had tens of women who had nearly died because of the abortion thing. Even in the Times Union, I mean, not exactly your most conservative paper, there was a big picture of Trump, a big discussion of the Trump rally, and the last two paragraphs mentioned, and Harris also was campaigning in Texas on the abortion issues. So, I mean, you know, I've seen pictures of Trump every time I've opened the paper, every time I've looked at my news feeds, and almost never do you see Harris in quite the same you know, it's always her. There, it's like it tends to be a close-up of her and someone else and a few people behind them. And Trump, you're starting to see, you know, big groups and lots of yelling. And I don't know. That depressed me a little. But where my real fear is from the numbers point of view is where I think Harris really, really could have had a huge undercount in the polls and still probably has a huge undercount in polling is the youth vote, the 18 to 35. But what really worries me is the Gaza situation is going to cause those people to simply not vote. You're sitting in an encampment on your college campus. You're angry at the government. You know Trump is even worse. What are you going to do? I mean, to force your, you know, to go out and vote for who you perceive as the enemy or to just stay in the encampment and hope for the best. And I don't know that if that holds in some of these larger campus towns in places like Ann Arbor, some of the Pennsylvania campuses, that could cause a diminishment. You know, that's typically been a bloc that doesn't vote heavily. It looked this year like it was, I mean, there were more registrations, there were more action, there was more contributions from that demographic than in a very long time. But I just am hoping that that one issue doesn't sink things.
We welcome your thoughts on all of this. We would love to get you into it. I know it's been a little while, so let me remind you that all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we know you probably have a lot to get off your chest, so we'll give some extra time to the letters this morning. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation with our incredible panel after we take a news break from the BBC. Coming up.
In fact, she pushes me along. It's a patchwork quilt of a life. Can't stop the river.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Terry Gibson, Jim Hendler, Nick Rangel, and of course your calls and not calls. No, we're not going to do calls. We're just going to do, like we always do, letters. And it's, no, enough of the phone number, Jim. Enough of the phone number. We're just going to do letters, and all you have to do is go to panel@wamc.org, and we will get to those throughout the program. panel@wamc.org. After the fun drive, we had a weekend, and I thought, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll go down to the city with a friend, and I'll walk around, and we'll see stuff, and we'll go see a show, and it'll be great. And it was a perfect day. The weather was gorgeous. I didn't know fully, or my brain did not make the connection that above Penn Station was the Trump rally. And the closing argument, which, by the way, they started letting people in at noon. I think the speeches started at about 2, and then but Trump didn't start speaking until 5:30, and then spoke for over 2 hours. I tell you all of this is because like nothing was moving in the city. It took so long to get out, and then into the train, it was just like this funnel directly from Madison Square Garden into the Empire Service train going north. And it was really fascinating to watch, although a little frustrating because, it took so long to get there.
But you can get takeout wine. At the deli.
At Don Pepe.
To entertain yourself while you're in that tremendous line and stuck on that long train.
Getting anywhere near it was almost impossible unless you were underground. I have to say it was very, very difficult. Anyway.
Travel wine. Just throw it in your bag.
Trump hosted the rally featuring crude and racist insults at New York's Madison Square Garden, turning what his campaign had dubbed as the event where he would deliver his closing message into an illustration of what turns off his critics. With just over a week before Election Day, speakers at the rally Sunday night labeled Puerto Rico, quote, a floating island of garbage, called Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris the devil, and said the woman vying to become the first woman and black woman president had begun her career as a prostitute. The normally pugnacious Trump campaign took the rare step of distancing itself from some of the speakers, saying that the comments, not all comments reflected the views of President Trump or the campaign, but they were invited.
That's wild.
It reflected the former president's tone throughout the third White House campaign, though he refrained from doing so Sunday. Trump often tears into Harris in offensive and personal terms himself, questioning in recent weeks her mental acuity as well as her intelligence, as well as calling her lazy, long a racist trope against used against black people. And before I move off of this, I just want to say that I was listening to various accounts while I was on the train last night, and people were like, Hulk Hogan was there, and Dr. Phil was there, and Elon Musk was there, and Elise Stefanik was there, and Mike Johnson was there, and Rudy was there, and Melania was there, and it was quite the event. So, and Tucker Carlson. That's the way that they are announcing or summing up their campaign. Meanwhile, Vice President Harris is spending a lot of time not in states like all blue states for Trump, like New York, but going to the swing states in which the race is incredibly close, and spending time in Pennsylvania as well as North Carolina and Texas. But again, I think what I wanted to get to just for a moment, Terry, is being our communications specialist, but I want your thoughts on the media in the sense of this idea of what Trump says, how it's being covered by the press, and ultimately if it has any effect on how people actually think about the race and about the candidate.
Well, I think, of course, that depends on what side of the aisle you're on. I think that my observation has been that at least the legacy media has continually, even since his first election, put his messaging above whoever the Democratic opponent is. This is an example today. If you look at the New York Times, the Washington Post, you're going to see that at the top, it's all the coverage about all the horrible, nasty things that Trump and his guests said at the rally. And then down below, it's going to talk about Kamala Harris campaigning at Puerto Rican restaurants and at barbershops and talking about all the good things she's going to do to help those communities. And I think what happens is that this continual coverage, high-level coverage of Trump's awful statements and negativity really brings the American citizen down. It darkens their views of government. It darkens their views of politics. It darkens their views of possibly even the Democratic Party. And it makes them possibly not as excited to vote. And I think this is one of the real dangers that this media exercise has created, is that it has really sort of darkened the skies of the United States for a long time now. And I think it's important that we all recognize that these are corporate-owned entities, that they are there to make a profit. That is their number one objective, and they are going to ultimately put at the top of their pages what they think draws the most eyeballs. And unfortunately, what draws the most eyeballs is disgusting statements by disgusting man, as was demonstrated this weekend. I think it's also important to point out that not only were all those other people at his rally at Madison Square Garden, you had the Speaker of the House there. You had one of the chiefs of police, a patrol of New York City there in uniform. I mean, these are dangerous dangerous times we're living in here. These are people that represent enormous amount of authority, and to go in and endorse and be seen and be present while these disgusting, racist, awful things are being said, it doesn't speak highly of our country. It doesn't speak highly of the New York City Police Department, if that's how they want to conduct themselves. And it certainly doesn't speak highly of the Speaker of the House, which is supposed to represent the entire United States. And I just hope everyone realizes that this is the Republican Party. This is what they stand for. They have clearly laid out who they are and what they want the rest of the country to be. And we should do everything we can these final days to fight against it.
You know, Terry, I think you bring up something very important. So one of the polls I saw that I thought was most interesting, because it wasn't a candidate poll, it was a poll on do you think American democracy is working? And it was carefully worded. It said, even if you don't exactly agree, pick one. But 75% of the respondents said no. And what's interesting about that is if you look at, you know, let's assume it was split 50-50. Let's pretend every every Trump voter said no, right? Then you'd still have half of the Harris voters, or if all was what you're really seeing is both parties, large percentages of people saying the democratic process is broken for different reasons. But this is scary because it reflects on all the aspects of government, on trust of government, all the way down to the local level. You're starting to see, you know, if you just look at the local newspapers and look at what's going on in Rensselaer and in Saratoga around here, you're seeing politics at a level that I've never seen it before in terms of the pettiness and the vitriol. And, you know, that's the part I think that I find most depressing. I mean, I'll obviously be very depressed if the election doesn't go the way hope it does. But I think I'm even more depressed by the fact that authoritarianism grows in that darkness. And I have a couple German students who, when they were in college, they had to study the Weimar era. And they're saying that it's just scarily similar, not so much the Trump is Hitler thing, but much more the what was playing out on the streets, what people were thinking, things like that. It's just a scary time.
I think so. I agree that mainstream media is spending a tremendous amount of time talking about Trump, but so are the Democrats. I listened to Harris's CNN town hall, and every single answer she gave ended with, but Trump is a terrible person who is a fascist, right? All of the like the Democratic approach, the campaign approach right now in this moment is also focused on Trump. What I do think could be a better or an opportunity for the Democratic campaigns is to actually demonstrate that if Harris is elected, that they have a strong plan in place in case there is violence, that they have a strategy in place because Trump won't acknowledge that he lost that election, that they have built a network of support, of legal protections, of physical protections, so that people don't feel so scared. And instead, they're leaning into the fear. And I think that's a mistake, because then they're also giving Trump the main stage in their message as well. And I don't think that that needs to be the only message. I think that the Democrats could put forward its own separate identity, its own separate message, and I don't think they are.
So,
you know,
go ahead, Terry. Then we'll take a break.
Well, I share Nick's frustration with everything she just listed. I'm completely there with her on that. But on the other side, as a person who spends all of his time examining how people communicate, the campaigns are about strategic communication. This is the most well-funded, the Harris campaign is the most well-funded campaign in the history of campaigns in the United States. They have extensive resources to do extensive focus groups and polling. And I'm convinced, after having listened to and watched Harris make these comments, the same comments that Nick just referred to over and over and over and over again, when given the opportunity to answer the question differently, that they have internal information that has convinced them that this is the way she needs to answer these questions. Yes, it is frustrating to many of us. It is confusing to many of us. But she does it so consistently that I think it's more about candidate discipline, sticking to the campaign plan that is being based on significant polling and surveys that show them that this is the message that will get them elected. And, of course, getting elected is the main objective.
I agree, and I understand that the strategy is well thought out and is very intentional. What I would counter with is that the responses she gave in last week's town hall were underwhelming at best. And it's possible that the drilling into the Trump is a fascist line is the next best thing, because, and from my perspective, she's not landing very strong responses to those difficult questions that are presented to her from the so-called swing voters.
Well, and I also
I'm sorry. Oh,
okay,
Go ahead.
Thank you all. Let me take a break. When we come back, we'll hear the comments of our panelists. We'll also go to the letters. We welcome you. See, we have so much to say because it's been so long, and we're really happy to be back, and we thank all of you. We will return right after this.
Served 20 years from walking on the water to stop fishing for love in the rain, for an easy chair in the passing lane.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, Terry Gibson, Jim Hendler, and Nick Rangel. We also welcome you, the home listener. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Before I go to the many letters we have, is there anything anyone wants to clarify or
You know, I just wanted to say, Joe, that while I think Nick and Terry are right to some extent, I think Harris came out swinging at the economic issues, the housing issues, the poverty issues, you know, the cost of raising kids, and then, you know, had these incredibly good job numbers, incredibly good inflation numbers. Inflation's at 2.4%. The average American at the moment asked to guess inflation is guessing 7 or 8, which was the absolute height of the worst of the Biden. I mean, so there's just this underpinning that trying to run on policy just isn't working in America. And again, that scares me in its own way.
Anybody else before we go to letters? Hearing none, we'll go to letters. Brian says, in the time remaining, Harris should stop being distracted by Trump's antics and debunk false beliefs out there about the economy. Biden and Harris did not cause the high prices. It was mainly the post-COVID supply chain issue and also bipartisan spending for COVID recovery and Trump's messes. Trump's economy before COVID was inherited from Obama, including low inflation. Meanwhile, the economy is back to booming. Immigration is down, too. And those young people should also vote on other issues like reproductive rights and global warming. Then we go to Lori, who says, I've got just one word for Kamala Harris, ceasefire. If she would demand it, it could give her the bump she needs, and I might not have just voted absentee for Jill Stein. Let that sink in for a moment. We go to Mike, who says, if you're going to continue to decry turnout rates for young people, you have to acknowledge that this dynamic is in large part the result of distinct choices by the Harris campaign and by extension the Democratic Party leadership. It's not just Gaza, which is looking more and more like a strategic blunder. Harris has defined herself by tacking hard to the right on many issues, healthcare and immigration, to name two, that young people and progressives care about. There's also the choice to emphasize the endorsement from Liz and Dick Cheney. This is also a slap in the face of people who still hold a lot of contempt for those two. Can we acknowledge that there is a trade-off to these types of choices, or rather, if you move too far away from the progressive base, which skews young, you risk losing those voters?
That's a good point.
That from Mike. Kathleen says, a few thoughts from me on last night's horrifying, disgusting, racist rally at Madison Square Garden. First of all, I think it will lose him voters, especially people of color, including Puerto Ricans, who were told flat out that they are garbage. Second, Governor Hochul needs to put out a statement denouncing it. Maybe she already has. I'm not sure. I guess denouncing the rally. And then third, the governor needs to remove Mayor Adams from office. Adams refuses to endorse Harris because he has his hand out to Trump for a presidential pardon. He is a disgrace. Listening to Mayor Adams defend Trump against the generals who had called him a fascist was fairly fascinating to watch.
I was stunned by that. You know, there's if you go to Wikipedia, the definition of fascism is very clear. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but far right, authoritarian, ultranationalist, dictatorial leader, centralized autocracy, militarism, belief in a natural social hierarchy, subordination of individual interests for the perceived good of the nation or the race. It goes on and on and on. But, I mean, it's literally every single word that was said at that Madison Square Garden fits into at least one, if not all, of those categories. And hopefully some point today we'll get to touch on Elon Musk and his influence on this race. But certainly, you know, I mean, problem is it seems like fascist doesn't carry the weight it once did, right?
Well,
calling someone a fascist was like a real insult. Now it's like I'm seeing people with MAGA and bumper stickers saying, "What's wrong with fascism?" I mean, it's ridiculous.
But I think partially because the use of the word has become so prevalent to describe kind of anybody who is has nationalist leanings without tying it to the reason people are invoking fascism as an insult, which is like this relationship to the Nazis, right? And when you just sort of throw around that person's a Nazi, that person's a fascist, and you do it over and over and over again, which we've been doing and which I've been hearing more and more of in the last like 10 years, it waters down the original intent of kind of drawing attention to those predilections, those leanings in a candidate like Trump, right? And people are not really tying his preferences, his interest, his goals to what the results or outcome could look like if he actually achieved all of them, right? Like, if he actually achieved an authoritarian regime, if he actually achieved a dictatorial regime, I think we have a little bit of a mental block because we just don't believe it could happen. Like, yes. We just don't actually think that's possible here because our, you know, separation of our three branches and the sort of, I guess, influence or distance between the president and the military, that we believe that we are actually protected from true fascism sort of reigning across our entire government system. And I think that's part of why people aren't as offended as maybe they should be, yeah, or as upset as maybe they should be, that that's where multiple generals, that's where Kelly keeps going to, right?
Terry, 2 minutes.
I think it's also, it's just to add to that, I think it's also related to the fact that we now have multiple generations of citizens that have no real connection or memory of anything related to World War II, which was really the last time our country was really under serious threat of a fascist enemy. I grew up with relatives who had either served in that war or had some connection to it. So I heard stories as a kid about it. I heard what it was like to sort of live in that fear and that threat. But as generations have gone on and our country has become safer and more secure, and we've not had, fortunately, any type of world war, and we haven't had those kind of encounters, I think it's just become easier for the citizenry to kind of forget that threat really exists and what can really happen, and to take it for granted. And it's unfortunate. And I'm hoping that we all get out there and do what we can to prevent it from happening.
All right. Last, give Terry the last word before we go to a break at the top of the hour. We welcome.
Oh, I don't want that responsibility. That's too much.
But don't worry. I could end with letters, but I'll start with those on our way back. And don't worry, Terry. No one's going to hold you to it. We'll be there. We'll be back right after a break. And when we come back, we'll welcome your letters. We'll move on to other topics as well. Still a lot to catch up on. Terry Gibson, Jim Henler, Nick Rangel, and more after news with Ray Graff.
One afternoon on the cover.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 6 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Monday, the 28th of October. A growing number of current and former journalists at the Washington Post are criticizing the legacy newspaper after owner Jeff Bezos decided to withhold a planned editorial endorsement for president for the first time in 36 years. The Washington Post's decision not to make an endorsement in the presidential campaign is a terrible mistake, said a joint column that it has been signed by 17 Post columnists as of Saturday afternoon. The opinion piece published on the paper's website argued that presidential endorsements serve as a reminder to readers of what the Post stands for. It declared that the paper cannot retreat from its responsibility to stand up for core democratic values threatened by Republican president candidate Donald Trump. Its editorials have repeatedly warned that Trump is unfit for office. An independent newspaper might someday choose to back away from making presidential endorsements, but this isn't the right moment when one candidate is advocating positions that directly threaten freedom of the press and values of the Constitution. That, according to a letter signed by Pulitzer Prize winner Eugene Robinson, David Ignatius, and Jennifer Rubin, among others on the Post staff. NPR first broke the news of Bezos' decision. The column arrived just hours after publisher William Lewis made the announcement Friday afternoon in his own opinion piece. Lewis explained that the Post did not routinely make endorsements until 1976. He said it was time to return to that tradition and support, quote, readers' ability to make up their own minds. The Post had drafted an editorial endorsement for Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris earlier this month, but it was ultimately scrapped by the paper's billionaire owner, Jeff Bezos, also the Amazon founder, the Post reported. The Post revelation came just days after it was reported that the Los Angeles Times owner blocked the paper's editorial board from endorsing Kamala Harris. Two other columns published on Friday expressed frustration with the Post decision. I've never been more disappointed in the newspaper than I am today. Two quick things to add to this discussion just very quickly before we turn it over to the panel, because it's a story that I've been looking to. By the way, I really want some of our journalists on today, but they were all sick, so they'll be here tomorrow.
And we hope you feel better soon.
Yes, indeed. Marty Baron, who was just on the show right during the fun drive and was the former editor of the Washington Post, slammed the decision by his former newspaper and said that I see this as a betrayal of the core principles of the Washington Post. He calls the circumstances in which the decision was made just days before a consequential election highly suspect, and yet he hopes people keep their subscriptions to support the Post's journalists. That is the other point that I wanted to make, is that indeed There have been tens of thousands of people who have canceled their digital and print subscriptions to The Washington Post in the days after this. And I will tell you that already I have referenced The Washington Post in an article that we started and have already received a couple of people saying that we should not read the reporting as a result of this. I think it is important to take a look at the management position versus that of the journalists. And final point is that if you realizing that many of you don't get the print version of it, but the New York Times yesterday was really incredible in that it took an entire page. It's online too. A version of it is online.
Yeah, beautiful.
But it's a full page of the opinion page, and it's in, I don't know what, like 70 point
8,000
type. Yeah, point type. And it says Donald Trump says he will prosecute his enemies, order mass deportations, use soldiers against citizens, play politics with disasters, abandon allies. And then in a gray font, it says simply, believe him. And that is the front of the opinion page and also online for the New York Times. Terry, I'll let you have first crack at this.
Well, the Washington Post story is very disappointing. It strikes me as really problematic when you have some of the wealthiest individuals in the world owning some of the major communication media platforms in the world. Elon Musk is in that category. Obviously, Jeff Bezos is in that category. And, you know, it's important to remember that in fascist countries, the media is simply there to serve the needs of the government. They're simply there to communicate what the government wants you to hear. And if we have corporate owners of these platforms deciding to be cautious about how they go about using their platform because of fear of being reprimanded by a government official, such as the president, then we're in a pretty dark place. And kudos to the New York Times for standing out amongst that group and being willing to put out the truth and to not kowtow to a politician of any party. Although, in my opinion, the New York Times has been a little late to the game in terms of coming around to really being honest with the American public about what they're seeing from Trump. But they're doing it now, and I appreciate that. The LA Times, you probably mentioned that too, did a similar tactic with their owner refusing to endorse. And I think it's just important that we all realize that we have choices about where we get our news and where we get our information. And the more independent source we can find, the more investigative journalist ability, the more they have staff there that can actually go out and investigate these things and give us the truth, the better off and more informed we're going to be. So I'm not going to the Washington Post right now. I am personally protesting.
So I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Jim.
You know, I think there's a back factor to this, which I found stunning, because when I first heard this, I'm like, wait a minute. Trump has been attacking Bezos for years. Trump threatened to shut down the Washington Post. Trump has done horrid things talking about Amazon stuff. But here's the thing. There are right now two competing organizations that want to have significant investment from the U.S. government in space. SpaceX, run by Elon Musk, and Blue Origin, which is Bezos' company. And right now, the numbers of dollars that they're talking about coming from the government to space is in the billions. So I think what you're really seeing here, to some degree, is that Musk has really been throwing his power around by really pushing the endorsement from Trump, shaking his hand at the SpaceX. There's a wonderful political cartoon that showed up the other day of on one side of the picture is Elon Musk saying, $1 million if you'll vote for Trump. And the other side is a guy being hauled off to jail by two policemen who said he was giving drinks to people waiting online
to vote.
You know,
yeah.
That's the waiting online to vote. Yeah, that's where we are. But I think that the power Musk has taken, because he's got his hands in so many industries, because he decided to go with this very specific, you know, I'm going to make Donald Trump president, and rumor is he'll get some kind of position in the administration. Frankly, is scary because that's where oligarchy lies. So you add fascism and oligarchy, and you're just talking about things that we haven't seen in this scary way in the States. From, you know, we've had oligarchy, we've never had fascism. Put the two together, it really is a scary situation.
I mean, rich people have always owned the for-profit media in this country. This is not like a new thing. I don't think there's anything new around the playing of politics or leaning left or right or endorsing and not endorsing. Like, this feels very sort of regular, very rich people thing to me, because the difference is no one expects privately owned journalism to be completely independent of the fact that their owner does have a stake in the results of an election. And I think that's been true. I mean, we talked for years about Murdoch and like how Murdoch, like, you know, played politics with his many media outlets. And that's why public media is the source for fair and balanced and complete and accurate journalism. That's why public media has to be preserved and protected away from business, you know, for-profit influences. But, you know, this shouldn't really be a surprise either. Trump, as you noted, has been going after Jeff Bezos and Amazon for years. And in 2019, Trump, and I'm like reading this from an article in the Intelligencer, Trump found his lever against Jeff Bezos. Amazon was due to receive a $10 billion cloud computing contract with the Pentagon. The Pentagon suddenly shifted course to deny the Amazon contract. And a former speechwriter for Defense Secretary James Mattis reported that Trump had directed Mattis to, quote, screw Amazon. Right. So like, this has been a kind of the path for Jeff Bezos for quite some time, and I think we're seeing that's what the journalists at the Washington Post are also saying today.
So, other, Nick, I think the one thing that's different there is for a lot of the media that has been seen as, quote, central nowadays, central means leaning left by some people's definitions, but the Post, the New York Times, L.A. Times, some of these others. I mean, L.A. Times came out with an endorsement for Adam Schiff. So, you know, it's not like they haven't endorsed candidates, right? But what I think here is different was that traditionally the editorial board has been kept protected as much as possible from the owner. You know, they can't totally override things, and obviously the owner can hire an editorial board with a particular thing. But in this particular case, in both the LA Times and the Washington Post, the owner overrode the editorial board. And, you know, the number of members of that editorial board who've resigned from the Post who've said, this has never happened before, this is not our newspaper. I think that's the thing that's different this time is, you know, it's not like, well, we're going to move a little bit more to the right or we're going to move. It's, I very explicitly killed something that this editorial board that's supposed to be independent did.
This letter from Dan, it's the customer base of Amazon that Bezos is worried about. That's his bottom line. Let the Post continue with their editorials. They won't be stopped by their owner yet. Although it seems in this case they were. Wouldn't a more effective way of protesting the Post decision be to boycott Amazon? And I've heard a lot of people say this, including Marty Baron, the former Washington Post editor saying by boycotting the Post, you're hurting the journalists and the bottom line of the newspaper, which by and large, let's not forget that there was an editorial there that was public or was that was written that was endorsing Kamala Harris. And also, this is the same editorial page that has the Pinocchios and has all of the opinions that are very left-leaning, let's say, and that has not been impacted. So there is that issue. Eric writes, they chose now to not endorse a candidate as if print wasn't dead enough. I hope the journalists who bust their butts to get us the news aren't hurt too bad because of this mismanagement. God bless free press and God bless America. And then we go to Charles. Well, I canceled my subscription, and that from Charles. I heard from a lot of friends, Terry, over the weekend that said that they had canceled their subscription or were getting ready to cancel their subscription. That is not something I chose to do, but I, for that reason, and well, I mean, I'll be selfish. The main reason is I also need it for this show. But I do think it's an interesting point of hurting the very journalists who are breaking these stories and are winning Pulitzer Prizes and the like for the journalism that they're doing. Terry Gibson.
Oh, you were referring to me. I'm sorry. I wasn't sure you were directing to me. I get my subscription through my employer, so I don't have to pay for it. I can't cancel it. So I just quit going to look at it. But I do think that it is worth considering whether we really want to support an organization that is run by a person that has decided that they would rather be political in terms of how they view their business rather than actually putting out a message trying to save democracy. And I think if you were ever going to take a position right now to try to influence the citizens of this country and try to put forth the truth, this would be a great time to put your stamp on it, because we might lose this. And then how is Jeff Bezos going to feel? And the other thing that doesn't make any sense to me is because Trump has been attacking Bezos for so long, Does he really think that by just not putting out an endorsement that somehow that's going to magically change all of this and they're going to become best friends all of a sudden? I don't think so. That doesn't seem to be the way that Trump works. So the whole thing doesn't just make any sense. And if you really wanted to not do an endorsement and put forth this sort of new policy about how we're going to go back to our roots, I might buy the argument if you decided to do that 2 months ago or 3 months ago. But to do it right before the election, it just reeks of selfishness and bias and all the things that I personally don't want to see in the media that I follow. And I think Nick's suggestion is right. We should spend more time supporting and looking at and listening to and engaging with public media, because that's really where we get what we really need.
Mary writes, I'm not dropping my subscription to the Washington Post in order to continue support of its columnists and award-winning journalists. Journalism has become one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. Trumpism is adding to that danger. It's not a good time for journalists to be job hunting. All this makes the Guardian's independence for the for-profit tar pit very appealing. Then, this from Ricky. If you are a Washington Post or LA Times reader, do you really need to be told who to vote for? How can media outlets be objective in their political reporting if they're actually endorsing one political candidate over another?
So Joe, that's where the independence of the editorial board is important. But the other thing is, if the Washington Post chose to endorse one, the other, neither, both, that would have very little impact. The decision to not endorse made national news. Same thing with LA. So in other words, in your seven states that matter, all of a sudden these guys have found a way to make a statement without making, you know. So in other words, Washington Post endorses Harris would not have changed anything in Pennsylvania. Washington Post refuses to endorse.
Well, can't endorse because it's received, because Jeff Bezos has been threatened by Trump. Well, right. Like, well, that's maybe. Right. Like, that.
It'd be nice if that was the message. But then democracy dies in dollars. So
I'm nice. I mean, the other thing, too, here is that do you all see a differentiation between the Washington Post decision not to endorse at all versus an issue that the owner of the L.A. Times had and was upset with the Harris position on Gaza and deciding to pull their endorsement? I mean, those are very different reasons.
I actually think the L.A. Times one was an excuse. There was already a drafted editorial by the L.A. Times editorial board in favor of Harris. The owner first said that, well, he was pulling it because it was supposed to have had the positive and negatives of both candidates, and he didn't feel did it. Then he turned around and said, no, it was really the Gaza situation. But the editors who resigned all said it was political, and it was, you know, it came down as an order to them, you will not publish that endorsement that you wrote. So they had already been ready to go out with their endorsement.
I think this one feels, I think the Washington Post feels more of a quid pro quo because there's just so much more of a clear line between the business interests of Jeff Bezos and his, as you've noted, his interest in getting these government contracts, where the LA Times owner just is a probably a conservative voter. So, like, I think there's more, I guess, upheaval around the conflict that Jeff Bezos has with his other business interests and bringing that into this decision. It is interesting. It's a little bit interesting because it is yet another demonstration of what all of Trump's like closest advisors have noted that are so core to his like fundamental values, which is like personal loyalty, that he requires and demands of anyone close to him to just demonstrate over and over again that they are like personally loyal to him as an individual. And when I read this article, I was like, oh, this is how that ties to his behavior and what he requires of people, as opposed to you know, the value and quality of the contract available under Amazon versus other competitors. It just is never that. It's always the personal loyalty, and it's kind of, I don't know, a curiosity.
I think Nick.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think Nick is pointing to something that indicates that this is, you know, a much bigger issue than just how they impact the media and the media platforms they own. We're speaking about Bezos and Musk in particular. But I think there's a bigger story, which Jim could probably speak to, and that not only are these wealthy individuals controlling major media platforms, communication platforms, and engaging with them in what I think is a political way in terms of decisions they make, but they also have enormous leverage over the future of how this country uses technology, specifically in communication, and in Musk's case with Starlink, and both of them, Bezos and Musk, in terms of space exploration, in terms of how that, you know, they're both integral into how we go about moving forward in the future of space exploration. And that is a security issue as well, of course, because the next battle in this world may very well take place in space. You know, it's to me, it's just a little scary that these individuals, both of them, are working so hard to gain favor with Donald Trump. What does that say about the future of this country?
I got to hold you there because we have to take a break. And when we come back, we'll finish up our conversation for this Monday morning, the 28th of October, and we'll be back after news from the BBC.
On your sweet face, all I'm asking.
Remembering Phil Lesh this morning, co-founder of the Grateful Dead, who died at the age of 84 on Friday. And our bumper musical morning has been that of Phil Lesh, and there is a playlist posted online at WAMC.org. Jay writes to us and says, what? The Post did endorse a candidate for president? Ah, what am I going to do? What if I can't figure out what to do in the voting booth and I accidentally vote for the other person? How can I function without some arbitrary spoon-fed, already known variable from a newspaper? Seriously, it's meaningless. Debates and topics like this that help support why Trump is doing so well against all reasoning. Anyone like to respond to that?
I couldn't agree more.
There you go. All right. Nick, I know you wanted in on this too.
No, I mean, I was actually thinking back to something Terry had said before the break, which was about kind of how Bezos and Musk and other, you know, I guess like billionaires are trying to gain favor with Trump as a candidate. And what's interesting is what I'm curious about is, what will they do if Trump doesn't win? Like, what does their relationship to the federal administration look like under a Harris administration? Because they've all but like snubbed her in every way.
It's still 50-50 according
and
to the.
And it's 50-50, right? Yeah. Like, you know, I just it just seems like a risky move to be offering $1 million to swing state voters for signing petitions in Pennsylvania every day, and then to have to go back to President Harris and say, hey, so can we actually be pals? I do want that contract. I don't know. It seems like a risk. And as a business person, it doesn't seem very smart.
I mean, to the letter writer just a moment ago, I mean, the problem, of course, is larger than what they just illustrated. I certainly understand the point, and not wrong. However, it is disconcerting in thinking about a newspaper where does it end? You know, what else is being killed? What else is not being brought to the fore? What else is not being mentioned and reported on? And of course, that is. Yes. That's a major
and
concern
the,
as a result.
The editor-in-chief of the Post, who resigned, brought up exactly that fact. He said, you know, most people don't understand the separation between editorial and news, et cetera, et cetera. He said, but absolutely critical to the function of a real newspaper is a belief by the public that they are telling the truth. And says, once you start seeing actions like this, then people start questioning, is the news being reported fairly? Are the things I'm reading on some of the other pages being reported fairly? And that's where faith in the media keeps dropping. And, you know, Terry, I'm going to turn that one over to you because you're the one who taught me a lot about that.
Terry?
Well, thanks, Jim.
Tag, you're it.
Yeah, it's important in a democracy to have an informed citizenry. And the way that we get our information is through the various news platforms that are available to us. We're fortunate in this country to have a wide array of options that we can choose from. They are, for the most part, all corporately owned. And my concern would be that if this becomes a trend where we begin to see owners of large media conglomerates beginning to make choices about how they go about using their platforms in relationship to whether they will or will not be seen favorable by the president who is in charge at the time or who they think is going to win a race, then I think we stand to lose a lot of that access to information. You know, it's if you're in a communist country right now or an authoritarian country right now, your access to information is really regulated. It's very difficult to find unbiased truth about what's really going on in the world in your local community. We're nowhere near that, of course. But you see these little things happening step by step by step, and it makes you wonder if we're headed in that direction. What's to stop Donald Trump, if he should win, from going into office and using his authority to go in and shut down or demand that some media outlets begin to cover his administration more favorably, or he will use his authority, which clearly is going to be unchecked, to just shut them down. We need heroes right now in the media. Jeff Bezos has proven not to be a hero. Elon Musk has proven not to be a hero. And so where are the heroes going to come from?
I don't think of the Washington Post as particularly left-leaning or a space where I would say this is objective, fact-telling information. The Washington Post was known for being one of the newspapers that most strongly and consistently supported the invasion of Iraq, for example. And that is true. That is true, right? There's a number of instances where the Washington Post has shown itself to have picked a side in a way that was not aligned with facts. And to say that, like, in this particular instance, there's an attack on a free press, I just don't think that's always accurate in for-profit media spaces. And I don't think that's an expectation I have.
We have some letters that I want to get to in the waning moments of our time together. This from Peter. When candidates discuss cogent plans, pundits claim it's too much for the average voter. You can't have it both ways. Make up your minds and stop telling us what we want to hear. Then we go to Lynn, who says there is only one way for any legitimate media outlets to cover the Trump event at Madison Square Garden. This is an American tragedy and should be treated as such. For me, most troubling is the presence of Elon Musk pouring money into the Trump campaign, almost to the point of paying people to vote. What happened to keeping money out of elections? Well, that's quaint, right?
Well, actually, there's, you know, he's been threatened with lawsuits, but he really carefully cleaved the line because he's not paying people to vote. He's paying people to sign a petition, which is not illegal, right? And then running basically a raffle if you signed it. So theoretically, you could sign this petition and then say, I'm going to go vote for the other person. That doesn't exactly counter the laws, but boy, it sure counters the spirit of the law.
We get this from Teague, who writes, I am a young white male college student holding out hope for a Kamala Harris victory and presidency. Firstly, I believe my college peers will and are turning out to vote. The young people in this election have been bombarded with hate and fear their entire lives, and they're fighting to do something about it in this election, especially women. Secondly, as a feminist who has seen firsthand the horror of the patriarchy and late-stage capitalism for men and women, I worry about the young men in my life. Talking about men's issues is not anti-women or anti-feminist. Do you have advice on how I can help the men in my life who I know are voting for Trump but will be worse for it because of how bad a president or person he will be? Would anyone like to guide Teague?
You know, I do think so. There has been more effort, and there should be even more effort in talking to young men about what reproductive health means for both men and women, and what reproductive freedom means for both men and women, and what happens in couples and what happens between two people when the when one party, when a pregnant party is unable to access health, right? And we hear all these stories about the women who have been at risk of losing their life or women who have lost their life because they were unable to access the health care. But what gets lost is that that person, in most of these cases that we hear about in campaigns, they had a spouse. And in many cases, they had other children. And maybe those children were boys, right? And their spouse were men and their children are boys. And they are directly impacted by the fact that mom couldn't get health care that she needed in the moment that she needed it. And when we focus entirely on women, it does feel like, and it does have the unfortunate effect of leaving out the men in her life and how her health impacts her family unit, which includes men. And so I do think that gets lost in some of these storytelling. It should be noted, you know, organizations like Planned Parenthood serve men and women, boys and girls, right? And reproductive, like men have reproductive health issues that and those men who utilize Planned Parenthood for their reproductive health issues, including sexually transmitted diseases, right, and other kinds of reproductive health issues that you need to see a doctor for. When Planned Parenthood's close, those guys lose out on those clinical services as well. And those clinical services are often the only or closest or most affordable resources available to men and women in those communities. So I agree that there should be more discussions and conversations around the reproductive health of men and boys. And that certainly does get lost. I think on the bigger question, like how do you help your, you know, male friends see the challenges or the impact that a Trump administration would have on them? I think we have to really drill down into, you know, Trump's policies on debt relief, student debt relief, Trump's policies and proposals around access to health insurance, the administration, his plan around, you know, deportation, right? We have, I guess Dreamers are not that young anymore, but thinking about, does he present a plan for improving employment that actually resonates with young voters? I would suggest no. And I think that education is valuable.
Well, you've all proven one thing this morning, which is that it's really nice to be back and doing the show and getting back to regular programming. Again, we thank everyone who made that a possibility by helping us during the lockbox and during the fund drive. And it's just wonderful to have you all back in this room talking about issues that matter and certainly matter in the run-up to next week's election. My thanks to Terry Gibson, Jim Hendler, and Nick Rangel. You're all wonderful, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.